Hi, I'm Paul Feig. I directed about 19 episodes of The Office. I was a co-exec producer for one season, season 5, and it was probably my favorite job I've ever done working on this show.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of The Office Deep Dive, probably my favorite job I've ever done. I am your host, Brian Baumgartner. My guest today is the only way to describe him, a bundle of joy, Paul Feig. Now, Paul was a director and a producer on The Office, that's true, but those titles don't quite do him justice. Paul was a core member of the team starting in season 2, so much so that when Greg started working more and more on Parks and Rec in season 5, Paul became our number one go-to in-house person on set for any questions or issues that came up. Paul was like the consigliere of The Office, you could say. And he had a huge influence on the show, as all good consigliaries do. But it wasn't just our show. Paul also created Freaks and Geeks and has made tons of fantastic comedy movies, Bridesmaids, Spy, the new Ghostbusters, so many more. And here's the thing. Paul once said that our casting director, Allison Jones, changed the face of comedy, which is true. But Allison says that Paul, along with Judd Apatow, changed the genre of comedy itself. Plus, Paul is hilarious. Just check out his Instagram. You'll know what I mean. And he's a super nice guy. And to top it off, he is the most dapper man in Hollywood. Definitely the only person who showed up for our conversation in a 3-piece suit. So on that note, here he is, Paul Feig.
Bubble and squeak. I love it. Bubble and squeak, I know. Bubble and squeak, I cook it every moment left over from the night before.
Oh my goodness! How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
You look amazing as always.
Back at you. Back here. Sure
great to see you.
I'm
oh my
so
God.
Happy to see you. This is so great.
Yes.
How fun.
It has been amazingly fun.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Oh, no. This worked out perfectly.
For sitting down. What are you about to do? You're working on something?
Yeah.
You're shooting a pilot.
You're going to shoot a pilot in North Carolina. So, getting ready for that, and then going to do a movie after that. So, you know, very nice and busy, which is
nice.
Great. Yeah.
Where in North Carolina is the pilot?
It's in Wilmington.
I was there. I mean, it's been now, oh my gosh, maybe it's been a little bit of time. This show, which you probably never heard of, mm-hmm. It was one of those weird things. It was a drama that I was a fan of, and they called, and I was like, yeah, it was Good Behavior.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's a cool show.
Oh, my gosh. It was so much fun. And Wilmington was great.
Oh, good. Yeah, this is my first time. When I was an actor back in 94, I shot a movie there, Heavyweights. We shot that. But that was more Asheville, Hendersonville. So it was more Blue Ridge Mountains. But I loved North Carolina. It was one of those cases. We get this every time I shoot anywhere. It's what we call want to live there-itis. Yeah. You start looking for houses. I want to live here.
Totally. Yeah, I mean, you start looking. Huh, I wonder what this amount of money will get me here.
Oh, I know.
I could be on the ocean. And
I always solve it by going, okay, now flash forward. It's the final day of production, and the trucks are pulling out of town, and you're there waving like, see ya. All right, here I am. And then it's like, all right, what have I done? Lovely towns, but what the hell are we showbiz people going to do?
Yeah, I know. okay, so what we're talking about is The Office.
Yes.
And now, 6 years after we've stopped filming.
It's been 6 years.
It's, by basically any measure,
the most watched show in television.
Oh, totally. I mean,
which is insane.
And people come up to me all the time about it, and kids watch. Well, that was the thing that always blew my mind. I wrote a couple of YA books, and so did these like middle school tours. And so when I would be promoting the book, it was kind of like the kids are like, well, whatever. So I just learned to pander completely. I was like, I work on The Office, and they would go crazy. And all they wanted to do was talk about The Office, and they loved it. So, yeah, it's got such a relevance.
Yeah. How did you get involved originally in the show? Did you watch the British version of the show?
Yeah, I watched the British version of the show. And actually, at the time, the agency I was at came to me and a million other people who had, you know, had shows and said, you want to do this? And I was immediately like, no, why would I possibly want to do that? Like, I can't take that on. You can only fail.
Like as a showrunner, right?
Oh, totally. Yeah. Just like, it's so iconic. You're like, you can't do it. Just get away from it. So, so then, yeah, a few years later, I had heard that they were, you know, doing it. And actually, the irony was I was shooting a pilot with Rodney Rothman called Early Bird back then. And so when we were shooting this scene, a writer's room scene, it was at the same studio where Greg Daniels was editing the pilot. And I remember him going like, hey, guys, come in. I'm going to get your opinion on something. We're trying to figure out what the theme music is going to be.
Right.
And so he played a couple of different songs, and then the piano one came up, and we were like, yeah, I think that's the one. That's really good. So I kind of like, wow, I was there for the beginning for the piano theme.
Oh, that's amazing.
Isn't that wild?
Yeah.
And then what happened was when it came on, you know the whole thing about how it had to be the exact script from
yes.
the British version. So I remember watching it and just kind of going like, oh, I was hoping it would be something else. I was such a big Carell fan. And so I kind of had this thing in my head of, oh, I guess maybe it's not going to, you know, go, even though it was great in it. And then I didn't watch the rest of the six. And then my agent called me up next year and said, oh, you know, that show's coming back and it's, you know, it's going to be this hot show. And I was like, well, I don't know, you know, but I like everybody involved so much. So then I went and watched the other five and went like, holy smokes, this is so funny. When I got to Diversity Day, I was like, this is one of the funniest things I've ever seen.
Right.
So then I came on board for the first full season.
Yeah.
And yeah, but I was at that first table read where they read the Dundies and all that. And then mine was Office Olympics was my first one.
Yeah. Office Olympics pretty early in season two.
Yeah, I think that's the third or fourth episode, I think.
Yeah, so Greg told me something interesting, that he, on the pilot, decided that if they stayed faithful to the British script, the network couldn't give any notes.
Oh, I buy that.
Because they were like, well, it worked over there. Like, how could you? And so what he viewed his job on the pilot, was to create the world.
Right. It was really brilliant what he did. I mean, the fact that, you know, it was partly some of you guys got cast, other people were writers. So he said, why don't you be on the show? And it created that great world for the docu-style. You know, the big thing that, you know, we've kind of all figured out going into season two, you know, the first six were trying to be very much like the British Office in the sense that Steve Carell's character was really unlikable. And it was when the 40-year-old virgin came out on that break that everybody goes like, wait, what's up? And it's like, oh, no, he's lovable. He can be a lovable loser, you know, and kind of be insufferable, but he has to have victories. And so, that was getting seated in, but it was really that moment I think we all felt in Office Olympics when Steve made the decision to start crying, you know, or get teary when at the medal ceremony.
Yeah.
I remember we were all kind of like, oh, that's it. Oh, my God. And it was just, it felt like you could feel that shift.
Well, speaking of that, that moment and the Halloween moment, both directed by you,
yeah.
People have talked about the softening of him and the showing of his humanity.
Yeah, well, remember in the stage directions for the medal ceremony, it was like everybody's kind of laughing at him. So it was supposed to be this big burn on him. But, I mean, it's all Steve. I mean, Steve made this decision to get emotional. And I remember we're all standing there like, oh, my God. So I'm just running up going like, Go further with it. It's this thing that I've just discovered over the years, because I love British comedy so much, and Brits really love unlikable lead characters, because then they just get to see them torn apart, and there's sort of a comeuppance with that, much like the British press, who
right.
loves to take people down. But American audiences can't get behind it. It makes them very frustrated. They want American audiences just want to invest in the lead character. It's the beauty of how lovely what a teenage country we are. We still have optimism and all that. And so I think it's great, but it's just this lesson I've learned over and over again, but I never learned it as fully as I did from my experience on The Office.
Yeah. It's interesting because if you look at sort of the iconic dramas that were happening, you know, around the time that The Office was going, they're unlikable characters that found humanity. Like if you think of Tony Soprano or Walter White, mm-hmm. or, you know, you have these bad, bad men that find a humanity that people mm-hmm. somehow root for. Was that a shift, or was it sort of okay in terms of drama, but not comedy?
I think the difference between more niche cable stuff and mainstream network stuff, you know, because this is back when, you know, when you guys started, the four networks ruled the roost,
yes.
which is just not that way anymore. And so I think, you know, to have that broad appeal, you have to have this formula. Sadly.
Right, right. Part of what we've talked about is that kind of this revolution in terms of changing the face of network television really started with you and Freaks and Geeks.
Oh, well, thanks.
What?
I'll take full credit. I don't know if it's true, but thank you, Brian.
No, I think so. I mean, you know, we talked to Allison Jones, and Allison talked about, like, her affinity for Misfits. And, you know, she cast Golden Girls and Family Ties and all of these traditional network shows. And then she talked about Freaks and Geeks being the first cool show that she did.
Oh,
and that she had an affinity, you know, for people who were sort of different. Mm. You do as well. Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, Freaks and Geeks was really my reaction to all the years of stuff I'd watched about cool kids and cool people in high schools, about all the, you know, it's like soap operas. I was just like, I can't take this anymore. It has no relevance to my past. And it makes me feel like a weirdo, like, what group was I in? So I really just kind of wrote it as a, you know, as a reaction to that. No, I mean, you know, there was things like Ally McBeal and stuff that were kind of playing in that world. There was also the movie Welcome to the Dollhouse that came out and was really influential for a lot of people. And what it influenced at the networks was they were all kind of like, we need to get a show like that. So I had kind of on the side written this spec pilot, and it just happened to kind of match into that. And so we chopped it around, and NBC just jumped on it in a great way. And we had one of these amazing meetings where you come in and they go like, we have no notes, just go shoot it. And it's like, what? You know, I go on like, I was all set for a fight of like, you got to let us cast, you know, nerdy kids. I don't want to cast like models. And then, you know,
right.
And they were like, no, we agree. So it was really great. The thing we brought that wasn't a lot of is just the idea of like a bittersweet comedy. That's like not a comedy and not a drama. That's sort of both. It's like mm-hmm. real life. Yeah, but it's why we got canceled. We only aired 12 episodes, and the people at the network were in love with the show, but the heads of the network just couldn't figure it out because it didn't do what a normal TV show does. It wasn't wish fulfillment. You know, I remember them always going like, why can't he get with the cheerleaders? Like, we don't have a show. If he gets with the cheerleader, right. It wouldn't be real life. I mean,
right.
None of our experience that there were writers. You want to bring a bunch of cool guys in. Sure.
Right.
Yeah, and then it just kind of, yeah, we just, you know, did it as long as we could. And I always credit NBC for letting us do what we did.
Right. Well, and I think it's why everybody who worked on The Office has a huge soft spot for Kevin Reilly, because he stuck his neck out.
Very
you know,
so.
He wasn't there when Freaks and Geeks was there, but by the time The Office came around, and he fought for it.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, he was the champion, the total, because I know that thing was, I mean, any other person would have canceled that show after the first six, just because of the ratings, You know, Freaks and Geeks was, we were in the basement of the ratings every week. Ironically, with 7 million viewers per week, which now we would be the biggest show on TV.
Oh, totally. Greg talked about that he was sure that the show would fail, and he talked about he felt like his contribution would be all worth it if somehow in the smallest of way he could nudge the ship of comedy in just a different direction, coming out of a friend's Will and Greg, you know, just that something that just he found funnier. He was like, it would have been worth it. Like if I had just done that.
Well, I mean, you know, I always say in comedy, there are these moments that everything jumps ahead, and he definitely did that. But you know, one of the many things that was in the way of The Office taking off in the beginning was that style, was that docu-style with the zooming camera. You know, now we're so used to it, nobody talks about it, but I don't know, you probably heard this too. You know, I can't watch it, it makes me sick, I want to throw up, it's the things go moving around.
Right.
But I always credit YouTube kind of created a world in which we could do this. Because, you know, comedy before that was, very overlit, very, you know, three camera looking, or if it's a movie, just very, you know, here's the shots, get the shots. And it was very joke-oriented, too. Everything was set up joke, everybody's really snappy and all this. And because of YouTube, people started finding so much humor in captured moments and things just happening on the fly, and you go, that's real, and that comedy became completely behavioral. And I felt over the last 10 years, people have no patience for jokes at all. If it sounds like a joke, they're still jokes, but they can't be like, you know, snappy, snappy, clever dialogue. It has, you know, on Freaks and Geeks, our biggest laughs would be, you know, Martin Starr's going, huh? You know, that, but they see it in the script, and back in the old days, they're like, well, you need a joke here. You need a punchline. Like, no, that's the joke. And, you know, one of my best friends is Matt Reeves, who did Cloverfield. You know, and people were like, oh my God, I'm throwing up and all this stuff. You know, now it looks, we see it all the time, so it looks great and you don't have a problem with that.
Right. Yeah. Greg and Ken Kwapis, Matt and Randall, you know, one of the things that they talked about was the idea that everything is harder makes it better.
Well, it was absolutely brilliant that he decided to get a real documentary crew to shoot this. I mean, it's honestly, I'm doing a pilot right now that I'm just completely copying what he did, because somebody like Randall and Matt, who were so brilliant, they are writers, they are actors, they are producers in the way that they do this, because they have the ability, coming from that world, to see the scene like they've never seen it before every time they shoot it. And as a director, it's my absolute favorite way to work, because it's all about performance. And it's also all about kind of, we're the audience, the camera's the audience going, wait, what? And he said that, and like, and kind of zooming in. And their ability to know when to zoom in on somebody is just, you know, people go, oh, do you direct that? It's like, no, I don't. Like, occasionally I go, like, oh, wait, hold off. Or like, ooh, maybe pull wider here. But in general, just like, you guys do what you're going to do, and then we'll kind of see if we want to change it. But 99.9% of the time, you're just like, man, they fucking nailed it.
Right. Right. So smart. And, you know, I've said before this and through this process, mm-hmm. that every shot, there was always a discussion about where the camera was, not in terms of getting the shot, but in terms of intention,
yep.
behavior, character. Is the camera in the same room? Are the characters aware that it's in the room? How does that change their behavior knowing that it's there?
Yeah, totally. I mean, that's why I've always had a hard time watching reality TV, real reality, quote unquote, real, because I just go, everyone's on camera. They know they're on camera. So I'm not watching normal behavior. I'm watching them playing to the cameras. And so the fact that they harness that, it makes the comedy so much better, because, you know, and we always, you know, they scripted it out a lot of the time, but it was always like, when's the spy shot? When do we want to catch people where they have no idea they're on camera? We're seeing the real person versus people that are very aware of the camera. And it's such a part of the writing. It's such a part of the storytelling that, you know, the fact that they use that and really played into it is great. Even down to things like, you know, the idea that on the Talking Heads, anybody who had kind of a bright future got to be against the window that looked out to the street, and everybody who was stuck in the place got, you know, the office behind them.
Yes, John Krasinski, Jim,
yes.
being toward the
Jim
window.
Jim and Pam, exactly.
Yeah, being toward the window.
You know, I remember coming in the first time, you know, the first thing I ever did when I was directing was the Talking Heads. You just started the day with the Talking Heads. And, you know, I came in and got all this whole thing of, like, really interview people. And I did. And you guys were so nice. You put up with it. I'd ask all these questions before I get to the scripted thing. But it was fun. I mean, for me, it was just this, you know, I've played with improv on camera before, but not to this extent. You know, because I worked on Arrested Development, which was so much fun, those scripts were so dense that even though we would do a lot of improv, it just wouldn't get used because, you know, because of the way they wanted to cut the show. So, you know, the fact that Greg, I can never say enough stuff about Greg Daniels. He's just so brilliant, and I learned more from him than I think anybody in the business. You know, the fact that he had the confidence to let us throw out storylines because we would stumble upon an improv. You know, and Halloween is the classic one with that thing with just Dwight, you know, looking like the Sith, you know, the Emperor. And we were just like, this is so funny, and that he went for it.
Just,
you know, that's so great.
Yeah, that's a great example. Yeah, of just a story that is funny, and let's let it play out as long as it can.
It's a moment. You go like, I recognize that. Oh, God, it looks like he's from Star Wars, and then you will do it, Michael, or whatever you're saying. I forget.
Yeah, no, totally. I can't remember if we did this by the time you were there. It started to peter out because the shoots got more complicated. But one of the things that Ken Kwapis did, and we did, I know, through the first season, was the 30 minutes of busy work.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Yeah. So coming in, and ultimately he wanted, and you know, Greg wanted it to feel like we had been there, mm-hmm. that we had been sitting there. So yeah. Even us being there for 30 minutes, it's like your chair feels different mm-hmm. than if you just sit down, which I think is so interesting.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, you know, one of the things I love about Ken is like he doesn't even say action. He just goes, go ahead.
Yeah.
And which is great because there is that thing. And when I do my movies and all that, I've purged it out of what I do, even though I still call action. But there is something about it leads up to this like, okay, everybody, and go. And it's this big event. That's why I always just go like, go again, to get people out of that thing of like, here it comes. They've just redone your makeup. The camera's rolling and go. And so, you know, the thing on The Office was always that the cameras never turned off until we finished a scene. So we just kept rolling, just kept going, moving around. Also, the thing that they were doing, and I think Ken started this too, is just saying like, all day, everybody has to be here all day. Just because we're in the office, we don't know who we're going to see in the background because the camera's going to be moving around. You know, and that carried on for a couple seasons until people started getting more successful.
I mean, but to a certain degree, it was there throughout. I mean, mm-hmm. even later, there were scenes that were taking place at the reception area. And Steve Carell was sitting in, you know.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, as Michael Scott was sitting in his office there in the background. No, I mean, it definitely happened.
But who drew the short straw in that whole series? It was poor Leslie
David Baker.
He was the only one we saw through the window.
Yes.
He was the only person that we saw when we do the talking heads that looked into the office. So he had to sit in his...
Right.
And Phyllis somehow escaped. Although I remember asking for some Phyllis to come in a couple times. I might see your hand.
Right. Just one other question sort of on this topic is, you know, basically, how do you feel like the fact that they were ordinary looking people.
Right.
That and the fact that we were all essentially unknown, how did that contribute, do you think, to creating that world?
Well, it made it much more relatable. It's funny because I always say, like, you know, we always try to go, you know, like, let's just cast really normal people. The minute somebody gets on camera, they do become appealing. It's just a natural thing that happens. So, again, it goes back to this docu-style. I think that is just the key to everything because it takes all the grandiosity out of the filmmaking process. You know, when you get your close-up, when you're in a movie or TV show and you get a close-up, we're tracking around you, it just becomes an event. It just eventizes little moments in life. And the fact that if everybody's sitting there and we're kind of at this sort of high angle because all the cameramen stand up generally, unless Randall's on his pooty scooty, what he called it, sitting on this little thing with wheels. We're seeing it the way, if we just walk through the office, that's how we'd be watching it. And that's why I think with the zooming in on people, it's just like you, as an audience, go, oh, I would focus on that person. And somehow in my brain, I would actually zoom in on them because your eye kind of does weird things that you don't realize as you're taking in details. And I think that's all contributed to making it feel just normal. And what then you can do when you have this thing of everything feels very real and everybody's underplaying, because also nobody on the show is playing big. But if something big does happen, it is in a real world context, so you can get away with it. So, you know, there's some pretty absurd stuff that happened on The Office, but you just go like, oh, that's funny. You don't go, if it had been shot in a standard movie way with like you zoom in on a wide lens, you do this and that, you'd go like, no, that's dumb, you know, or that's too much. But in this real life context, that makes it all feel real. And so, so, you know, but you guys were all very, very appealing.
Yes, in our own specific way.
Yes, exactly. You know, I've always said this about, especially it's more about like three camera kind of stuff, but it really applies to the best TV shows, the most popular comedies ever, which is it's generally in one place. That's why Cheers works so well. You go, oh, I'm going to go visit my friends in this place that I feel very comfortable in. And so that's what The Office had. And it's funny, as the seasons went on, they were always trying to get out of The Office more. And I was always kind of like, let's not go out too much because I love being in this place. Now it's my happy place.
Right.
So that, you know, that's what you had going for you. But then with this new style, which the funny thing was at that time, sitcoms were trying to break out of their three camera thing. And so if you watch, there was occasionally you'd watch a sitcom and they'd kind of put some shot in or they'd do something where it'd like be tracking down a hall and you're like, wait, what's happening? You know, this is not normal.
Right.
And it would
right.
distance you from it. But you guys had the ability to just have this freedom with the cameras.
Right. Backing up slightly, you mentioned Diversity Day. You know, I think that we've talked a lot about, I don't know what you want to call them, but issue episodes. That sounds so like right. weird.
A very special like, episode.
A very special episode. That wasn't the intention. But, you know, talking about really from our second episode in Diversity Day, beginning to talk about difficult social issues in a way that some would say hadn't been done on television since All in the Family in terms of looking at race, but looking at it in a different way with a protagonist who was the one kind of stirring the pot.
Yeah.
A lot of people have said it, and Steve himself said he wasn't a bad guy.
No, no.
It was just he wasn't woke enough.
Yeah, he's not savvy enough. And the great thing about Steve's character, you know, I also think Archie Bunker's like one of the greatest characters, possibly the greatest character I've ever been in comedy. But they're people who are just convinced they're right. Also, when they say something terrible, it's like, what? What did I say? What did I say that's so terrible? It's that weird innocence of thinking you can get away with it that really makes the difference. You know, there's no malice in that person.
But you talked about unlikable leading men, you know, being a very British thing. But it's funny, like when you look at television history and you bring up Archie Bunker, again, another sort of unlikable leading man.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, you know, that's one of the most challenging characters to be on TV. I think, you know, people have tried to replicate that so many times and it just, that was so specific to the time. Ironically, I almost feel like, I mean, I think almost we're even more divided now. I don't even think you could pull it off because everybody's so self-defensive. But back then, there was ability to, even though everybody's, you know, passions were high, you needed that steam relief or whatever to get these ideas out there. And also, you know, surround, I mean, that show's just brilliant because it's the wife who's just a saint and then the overbearing son-in-law who's too far the other way, you know, and then the daughter who's kind of caught in the middle. So if you kind of present a fair and balanced mixture of opinions, then you can have fun with it. And then if you, again, take the malice out of it, unless you need a villain, then everybody's just kind of misguided. Then it becomes about the appealingness of the people playing those roles. And I don't mean looks or anything. I just mean, do you inherently like them? And you inherently like Steve because he is just, he's so funny and also just, you know, he thinks he's doing the right thing. And you can't, it's hard for Americans at least to get mad at that.
Right. Where do you think that he fits in, Michael Scott, sort of in the history of comedy leading men in television?
I mean, honestly, it's a real close race between Carol O'Connor and Steve Carell for me. I've lamented this before, and whenever I say it, sometimes it turns the press remembers that this didn't happen, that Steve Carell never won an Emmy. Never won an Emmy, and it makes me mental. And, you know, and look, Alec Baldwin, I love him. He's the funniest guy in the world. He's great. But, you know, that was a showy part. And Steve's part, I mean, people would say it to me. They go like, well, but he just shows up and he just is crazy. And it's like, are you fucking kidding me? You know, first of all, if you know Steve, he's not crazy at all. He's one of the most even-tempered, smart guys I've ever met in my life. But for comedy to be good, it's got to look easy. If it looks sweaty and it looks like people are trying too hard, it's terrible. But then when you do so great that you make it so real, people go, well, you're not doing anything. So at some point you just go, you know, awards mean nothing and screw it. Let's just throw it out. But the fact that there's a comedy leading man category and he can never win it is crazy. And I really think Academy, do you like the President's Award or whatever, where you give somebody who's been not taken care of, give them that Emmy.
Yeah.
And should be like 5 feet high.
Yeah. Yeah. when I was talking to Rain, I said to him, the comedy duo of the two of them together, yeah. You referenced the Halloween episode too. Mm. They're just so funny.
Yep.
They're just so funny. And there's just, it's these two archetypal characters and the way that they fit together was just brilliant.
Yeah, and there's not really a parallel to them because it's not Laurel and Hardy, you know, and it's not Abbott and Costello because of that. Exactly what you're saying. It's this weird, they need each other, but Michael doesn't want Dwight's acceptance. And it's really, I mean, but, you know, such credit to Rain. I mean, what an amazing character he pulled in to be. A character that could have been so over-the-top arch, but there is a humanity in him because he's just that guy that we all know who's just, like, striving and wants it so much and tries to kind of throw everybody else out of the way, but he's still sensitive. And, yeah, it's really, I mean, you know, and Rain is the greatest guy, too.
Yeah. Well, and part of why the show is so popular, I think that Dwight Schrute, this character full of contradictions that don't make any, like, heavy metal, Dungeons and Dragons. You know, like, all of these weird right. things, but they're so specific that that is actually what makes it universal, that people, like see that it's a real character, a real person.
Yeah, I mean, because characters are all specifics. You know, when you get in trouble when you're writing something is you just kind of have this general kind of feeling of what your character does, and it, you know, it's really going through that Laos Egri list of, like, specifics. What is their religion? What do they believe in? What are they afraid of? You know, what's their favorite food? Those things make up who we are, if you think about it. I mean, you know, that's it's like, how many times do you meet somebody you really like them, then you'll find out one thing and you're like, wait, what? You know, right. Either suddenly you don't like them because of it, or you feel really bad for them, or, you know, so it is that attention to detail. And that's a great thing about a television series, is that you have week after week to keep establishing these things and to surprise people with, you go, oh, I thought I knew exactly who that person was. And you go, like, oh, you think you know? Check this out. And that's what's brilliant about it. I've gone to movies because I get more of a stomach ache thinking about having to do stuff week after week, because I'm a little more of a singular
right.
task person. So that's why when a show is consistently great week after week, year after year, it's like a magic trick or something. And, you know, and just, you know, hats off to those writers. I remember just standing watching them from the other side of the room going, like, that is the most brilliant group of writers. Like, you'd be hard pressed to put together a gang like that again, you know, and everything they came up with was brilliant. And I would just sit in that writer's room and just go, wow, you know, it's Marvel. You know, it's occasionally I try to pitch a joke and they kind of look at me like, okay, you know, I'm like suddenly dad in the room, like pitching some shitty old hacky joke. And they're like, okay.
Well, I heard, as it's been explained to me, like in a writer's room, you really have the people who start and they're really good at story.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, the you know, they're people. The senior people. Then they're the, yeah. then you hire in the joke people. And then eventually the story people leave. Mm-hmm. And then you just have the joke people kind of running the ship, but they're not as yeah. good at story.
Yeah.
But, I mean, when you think of Jen Salata and Paul Lieberstein and Mike Schur and
Mindy.
Lee and Gene and Mindy yeah. and BJ and, mm-hmm. yeah.
No, I mean, that's really, that's smart. I never thought about it that way, but it's completely true. People didn't have a specific thing they did that they were known for. And I think that is really smart because then everybody brought a depth of story and funny to everything they were pitching, you know, and again, sitting around that table and hearing the pitches, you know, when they were going through and punching up a script or whatever, it what that's why when I would pitch like a joke, it just like hit like a lead balloon. People go like, I'm just pitching like a funny word or a funny wordplay. And it's like, oh God. But I learned so much from that. Like, you know, came out of that whole experience of my years there going like, oh, you know, behavioral comedy. This is how it works. It was weird. That's what we used to do on Freaks and Geeks, but I would get in this setting of a half hour thing, go like, oh, you gotta be more
right.
jokey. And so, you know, what a brilliant group.
Yeah. Many people believe the greatest episode of The Office is Dinner Party that you directed. And you were not supposed to direct it.
Somebody else was supposed to direct it. And then the writer's strike happened. But I remember I had been given the script to Survivor Man, I think was the one. And I remember going like, oh, I like this script, but oh my God, can I please have Dinner Party? And it's just like, well, it's already been promised out to somebody else. I was like, oh no. So I mean, I've literally tried to figure out like how I could subvert it or whatever. And then the writer's strike dropped into our laps in a horrible way. And that was, what a terrible time that was. But it just happened to work out that when it came back, it was available for me to do because I think he was busy. And it was one of those things you just read and you go like, oh my God, this is the funniest thing I've ever read. But it's also what I love because it's so cringy. This is just going to be like excruciating. But that's my favorite kind of comedy. But if you remember, I think it was probably when it aired, probably our most hated episode. I mean, people did not like it because it made them so uncomfortable. And I remember being very surprised by that, but the feedback was coming out, you know, on the website, and we were just getting really bad feedback from it. So I'm so happy that now it sorted itself out. And it really taught me something that I didn't realize before that, which is the hardest part about just, you know, when you have a movie out or anything, if you have any kind of track record, people know what you do, you've got a voice or they're used to stuff you've done, that the biggest impediment to people enjoying something is the fact that it exists and they have to get used to it existing. And so, you know, they're used to the feel of The Office, which is fun and definitely has cringy stuff in it. But so then when this thing comes up and you're like, we're just going to dangle you in the wind and make you feel so uncomfortable that they're like, wow, I can't, how dare you do this to me?
Right.
But then when they watch, then they've gotten that out of their head and now they know it exists and they go back and watch it again. Then you go like, oh my God, this is the funniest thing I've ever seen. And that episode is so obviously driven by that cast and how funny they are. And this is one time where putting them in a setting outside of The Office worked so great because it was a setting that meant so much to one person. I mean, I don't think I ever laugh as hard as when we did the thing of Michael giving the tour of that living room with that little TV and then the shitty table. And it was just such a team effort between Steve is a performer and between Randall and I and Matt figuring out, like, you think you're on a big TV and you pull out this tiny thing and then how do we whip over to that shitty table? Oh my God, it was just so funny. But the thing I take away most from that episode was, and again, for the genius of Steve Carell, the big breakdown they have about having a baby, you know, that happens at the door and it got very dramatic. And you know, it's really like, I was like, oh my God, like Steve's really killing this and it's so dramatic. But then we all kind of went, okay, it's got to be funny. So I just remember going to Steve and going like, it's so good. What can you do to just kind of make it funny? And that's when he did the whole snip, snap, snip, snap, that thing. You know how many vasectomy has and that just like falling apart. And then be punching in on Krasinski, who just found the funniest moment to just, when he reveals the thing and just John, it just takes that little look to the camera and Randall crashes in on him. And it's the funniest, I think that's possibly the funniest reaction shot in the whole history of The Office. I'm so proud of that episode. And it was just so fun to put together. It was also fun just to go in and figure out, because I was the first person to shoot in Michael's condo when he bought it.
Yeah.
So then going in and going like, what did Jan do to this place? And that was just a blast that they just let us completely, you know, go wild with it.
Yeah.
Kimonos on the wall and
the big
Andy Warhol of Jan, which we never feature. It's just there and you go like, oh my God.
Yeah, exactly. So in season five, you came on as a co-executive producer, right? And that was really about, I mean, it came a function of, well, one, how great you are, and two, that Greg was sort of stepping away and beginning to go work on
Parks and Rec.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Why did you decide to do that?
I loved you guys so much. And it was really that when the opportunity was presented to me, I remember thinking like, this is going to be like the greatest schooling I've ever had, you know, and that was, I said, one of the things was I'd like to be in the writer's room too, which they definitely wanted, you know, allowed me to go in. Yeah. I don't know how helpful I was, but I was in there. I just really wanted to be more and more part of that show. I knew that how great it was. And obviously by that point it was a hit too, but you know, I couldn't get movies made, which was all I really wanted to do. But since I couldn't do that, I was like, I'm sitting with this amazing gift. I really want to just be a part of it. And you know, what happened, you know, when Greg brought me on too, just like a lot of people had in their contracts that they were going to get to direct an episode. And so he really wanted me there to help people. And I love that. I, you know, it was, so I got to, you know, be with Steve Carell when he directed his first episode. Yes. But I also got to be with, some of our editors when they were doing it too. And it was fun. And I also got to spend more and more time on the set, which I love. Like, I will fully admit, the one thing that I'm really sad about is I was not allowed to direct the Super Bowl episode because I think the network wasn't thrilled with the Christmas episode, the Meredith's
Moroccan Christmas.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think they had some issues. So I remember being kind of penalized because I was kind of like, well, of course, I'm the in-house director. I get to do the hour-long one. And then, you know, I didn't. And I remember just being very upset about it. And then it won the Emmy for the director. So.
Oh, yeah.
But he did a great job. I mean, amazing job.
You also directed Niagara. Mm-hmm. How did you find out ultimately how that the wedding actually played out with the other wedding in Niagara, et cetera?
Well, I mean, it was, you know, first of all, I was so excited to get to do that one. And, the first time we ever went on location to do anything on the show, even though all the stuff we shot at, that's supposed to be there was actually in the smokehouse.
Yes.
right a block away from my house.
Yes, yes.
My actual house. One of the greatest honors for me was also getting to do the proposal. Which was the most expensive shot we ever did in the show's history. That was the first episode of that season. And we basically blew the entire budget for the rest of the season on that shot, which cost, like $500,000 because it filled with CG and all
right,
this.
Right, right.
Anyway. When we got to the wedding, it was very emotional. It was weird because we were going to shoot on this, the Lady of the Mist or Maid of the Mist.
Maid of the Mist, under the thing.
So that just brought so many logistical things that you're kind of like, it was hard to kind of invest in the emotion of it at first because I was so worried, like, are we going to get soaked? Are we going to, is the camera going to screw up? But it wasn't until we got in the editing room. It was Claire, Claire edited it and I was there with her. When we decided we were going to intermix the dance number with the wedding and we just burst into tears. I mean, I get so emotional watching that because it's so beautiful the way that it goes back and forth between the two. But it's also, I'm jumping all around, but there were so many things in my head when we put that episode together. That dance number, which came out of the blue. I mean, do you know the whole backstory on, what was originally Greg had this insane idea that was hilarious that Dwight was going to ride a horse over Niagara Falls. And we were just like, I don't know if we want to kill a horse on Pam and Jim's wedding. And he kind of fought for it and then finally gave in. And so it was a very last minute thing. We had like a day or two and that wedding video was all over the internet. It was kind of the perfect setup. And then when we were shooting in that church all day, I mean, we had so much to shoot that we were running out of time. And I was like, literally had like a half hour left. And I was like, I don't have time to get this dance number. So we're going to have like maybe two takes at it. And the first time you guys did it, it was gold. And I'm just like, that's it. Drop the mic. Oh. We did it one more time, but we didn't need it because it was the second time. But it was really having all those elements to work with that it just gave us enough cards to really shuffle a beautiful deck.
Yeah. By the way, I don't know if you remember this, the people walking behind Jim and Pam onto the Maid of the Mist, my parents.
Oh, that's right.
Who were vacationing in Niagara.
I do remember that.
Yes, they were there.
Oh, my God. We'll see.
And I think you had met them on Company Picnic, the 100th episode.
Oh, yeah.
They had there, and I think you had actually met.
I remember that. I didn't direct that one, but I was there supervising.
Yes, so yes.
You keep an eye on your parents.
Yes. One other question I have to ask, because you just brought it up. You directed the proposal episode. Sound or no sound?
Oh, I was a no sound guy. Very much so. Yeah. Oh, wait, no, I was a sound guy. Oh my God. No, that was the most contentious moment we all ever had. No, I was very nervous about, it was so emotional to me with the sound. And I'm glad we did it because I think it made, flash forward to Michael's last episode much more powerful. If we had done that gag a couple times.
Yes.
But we did, their performance was so good and hearing her going like, oh my God, and all that. It just, we were already dealing with so much with all the across the, the highway and zooming in all these cars and all that. I remember fighting really, really hard for that. And I think Greg was always kind of on the fence of whether we should have done it.
Yes.
Talk about one word, literally. Hey, guy who fixes the cars for the show, come on in. What do you think?
Yeah. Someone told the story that he brought in a security guard and came in to watch it.
Oh,
he
yeah.
He was like, I remember that. Who are these guys talking? Like, he had no idea. Like, had never watched the show.
Right, exactly. Didn't even,
it was just like, which one should you use?
Yes.
You also directed Steve Carell's last episode.
Yeah.
Goodbye, Michael. What do you remember about shooting that?
Well, the biggest thing I remember, first of all, it was just so emotional. But that was what was interesting about it. You probably remember this too. Every time we were going into a scene, especially towards the second half of the week, it was that feeling of like, this is our last scene with Steve, this group of actors. And we would do the first few takes and there would be a real sadness about it. And I had to constantly go like, remember, we love Steve. We don't necessarily like Michael.
Yeah, right.
You know, and it would change the dynamic, but I completely got it because I was so emotional too. I was kind of falling into that and then going like, wait, this can't be everybody's weeping because it's not going to track with the whole rest of the show. And that also made me very sad for Michael Scott. Like, they like him, but they don't love him. You know what I mean?
Right.
But that's very real. You know, how many times you got people you work with, other than you go, oh, I'll miss them. You're not like, oh my God, I can't live without, you know, the boss, or I can't live without that manager, you know?
And, right.
But that was really, really hard because everybody wanted to break down. I also remember, and I have a picture, I've got to find it somewhere. It was the last day and we were shooting something. I looked over and Greg, you know, the couch, when you come in the front door, there's a couch next to the reception.
Yeah.
I looked and Greg was just literally laying flat out face down on the couch, just with this kind of his hands under his head. And it just summed everything up of just like, we can't believe Steve is going. We can't imagine life without Steve Carell on this set.
Right.
It was tough. The weird thing for me was that we shot the very last thing probably 3 days before the end of the episode, which was this thing at the airport with Jenna and Steve. And that got me more than I kind of thought. I mean, the last day got me, but I was so on task doing that airport scene. That was when I was just like, you know, and so it takes off the mic and just, you know, I'm actually getting choked up when I talk about it. Just seeing them, yeah, her going off and you don't know what they say and just her hugging him. And it was just, it was really something. But it really landed for me just what the show was. And it just, you felt like you were kind of part of history in that moment. And I loved everybody, but I remember saying, like, I'm not going to direct any more episodes because, look, and I love all the episodes after Steve left, but to me, it's just like, that was the group. You know, I almost felt like I almost had to leave with Michael Scott in a weird way, not that anybody cared, but it put a, such a completion to everything for me that was kind of like, that was it, weirdly.
Yeah. Because you didn't come back and direct after.
No, and I didn't. It was not any reason. I'm like, how dare you? It was just this really weird, natural feeling of like, oh, there's something. It's over. We're all gone. I don't quite know how to say it. It just felt like there was closure for me when that happened.
Yeah.
That said, I kind of wish I would have done some of the ones after because I missed you guys so much.
Right.
I'll tell you one interesting thing about that episode. When she goes to see the King's speech. Bridesmaids was going to come out, but it was coming out in a few months and we almost put Bridesmaids up on the marquee, but we all decided, well, what if it bombs? So we didn't do it.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, that's so funny.
So she almost snuck in to see Bridesmaids.
That's amazing. Well, and obviously Bridesmaids was huge and brought Ellie to a whole new level. Yeah. And really then from changing the face of television comedy, you literally changed the gender of American movie comedy with that movie as well. I mean, that was groundbreaking in its own way.
Right. No, I mean, it was what I'd always wanted to do. I love, you know, female led comedy and, you know, I would just for years after Freaks and Geeks and before it even pitch ideas that were female centric and it just, you know, they, oh, you can't do that.
Right.
You go, oh, okay. I guess they know more than I do about in showbiz. And you finally go like, well, wait, why can't you? You know, but it was really, you know, Judd doing Knocked Up and saying to Kristen, you're great, write your own script. And then they came up with that idea. Because I was at that table read back in 2007 when it was just, you know, untitled wedding movie. And, you know, and then 3 years later, we actually got to do it.
Right. Well, final, very quickly, what do you feel like the legacy of the show is?
Gosh, you know, it's a show that you just want to watch over and over again. I mean, there's a few shows like that in my life. Taxi was always that way. All in the Family is always that way. But The Office is always going to be that because it's just comfort food, you know, and it's a very, it's so funny, but it's so relaxing to sit with these people. The tone of the show is very relaxed. I love the fact that we didn't have any score, no music on the show.
Right.
You know, our sound mixes are always about, like, where do we put the phone ringing? Like, we're just always placing phones ringing in the background. And it just becomes this really low-key, relaxing, happy place that you can go to. And every episode, there's something, several things in it. You're like, oh my God, this is my favorite thing. This is my favorite thing. You know, it's always, you know, Monty Python, The Holy Grail is one of my favorite movies because every scene that comes up, you're like, oh wait, this is my favorite scene. Oh wait, this is my favorite scene.
Right.
And that's what this show is. Everything right. that comes up because you go like, you love these characters and you remember these moments and you can watch them over and over again because they're not sweaty and they're not trying too hard and they're not joke. They're just behavioral and beautiful and relatable, not intimidating. And it just makes you feel good about your life, and it makes you feel good about other people. You know, it really makes you, a show like this makes you tolerant of other people in a weird way because you're watching such different group of folks that have no reason to be together other than the fact that they are trapped within this building and this situation, much like school. You know, the only reason you're there is because you all live in the same area, right. And that's why you're there. You don't choose to be there. And so there's just something very lovely about that. And I think that's, you know, people will be watching the show for, you know, as long as the planet exists.
Well, Paul, seriously, I know this sounds so crazy, but you really are one of the greatest comedic geniuses that I have ever met. Your contribution, not only on this show, but in all of the work that you've done, is such high quality. You're such a good, caring person as well. So you're as Thanks. Smart as you are kind. So thank you, one,
thank
for
you.
Coming I in mean, and sitting kind. Down with me. And it's always, always my pleasure to see you.
And so. You too, Brian. You're the greatest. Remember where we first met?
Arrested Development.
Yes, yes. Exactly. Yes. And you were so funny, and then Mitch wouldn't let you do your bit.
Yes.
Because you had this really, really lecherous guy. And then, so I always felt bad. So when I finally got to work with you again on The Office, I was like, oh, yay.
Yes, yes.
Oh, and crazy. Let me just say, also, everything you've done is so brilliant. I still laugh every time I think of Michael's a genius. That makes me laugh so hard from that episode. That's one of our most undersung episodes too, the surplus. So anyway, I can't stop talking about The Office. I'm going to get out of here.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks.
All right, folks. That is it for today. Thank you so much to Paul for joining me. I know how busy you are. It is such an honor and a delight to chat with you. So thank you. And to all my listeners, thank you for tuning in. As always, please let me know what you thought of the episode from today in the reviews. It means so much to hear from you. And that is absolutely the best way to reach me and my team. We will be back. Same bat time, same bat place next week, and have a great one, everybody. The Office Deep Dive is hosted and executive produced by me, Brian Baumgartner, alongside our executive producer, Leng Lee. Our senior producer is Tessa Kramer. Our producer is Adam Macias. Our associate producer is Emily Carr. And our assistant editor is Diego Tapia. My main man in the booth is Alec Moore. Our theme song, Bubble and Squeak, performed by my great friend Creed Bratton. And the episode was mixed by Seth Olansky.